Welcome to the College Football Podcast with Herbie and Pollock. I'm your host, Kevin Agani. And today on the podcast, we've got the man, and that is Chris Fowler. This one's been in the works for a while, and we are excited to have him in the fold. Obviously, his background with Game Day, and he'll be calling the game, the national championship on Monday night on ESPN. So we'll get his thoughts about the game, what stands out, and also how he prepares for the game leading up to it, and also a very big question if you follow tennis, and he has an interesting answer. Also, if you missed it, go back and listen to yesterday's episode. We had Herbie and Pollock together at last, and we had a lot of fun. We talked about Matt Rhule, Tua's decision to turn pro, LSU, Clemson, a whole bunch of other stuff. Out of all the podcasts we've done this season, this is the one you don't want to miss. And finally, check out today's episode of ESPN Daily with Mina Kimes. She's talking about another football legend on today's show, Lamar Jackson. We're looking forward to watching him play on Saturday night. I think most football fans also agree. Check it out wherever you're listening to this podcast. Now, on to the show.
The College Football Podcast with Herbie and Pollock. Now here's your host, Kevin Nagandi.
We're 5 days away from the national championship between Clemson and LSU, and the man who will call Monday night's game on ESPN, the voice of college football on ABC primetime, Chris Fowler, joining us on the College Football Podcast. And Chris, you know, the big answer our audience wants to know, and you could give it to us, if you had to pick the best in their prime, is it Federer, Rafa, or Djokovic? Go.
That is the impossible question to answer. Aren't they all still close to their prime? It feels like they haven't declined that much. I mean, Djokovic has had some incredibly dominant years. So has Federer. I mean, Rafa, to me, has been the favorite athlete that I've ever covered. So you can't choose between your children, right? I mean, it's been phenomenal. You throw Serena in there, to have the privilege of watching all four of these all-time greats is incredible.
And, you know, obviously a little preview as we get ready for your other role down the road and the Australian Open and, of course, our Grand Slam coverage on ESPN and what you do there, brilliantly calling play-by-play with, of course, the McEnroe brothers. As we get ready for this game, I want to talk about a variety of things, clearly the matchup and your preparation. But one of the things I've noticed about what you do outside of the job on the air, when it comes to linear TV, if anybody looks at social media, which all of us do, they should find your Instagram account if they love college football, because you do a nightcap recap after every Saturday game you call. And I love it. I think it's fantastic. What was behind the process of doing this, deciding, hey, this is where I want to unwind. And I've got about 10 to 15 minutes to just kind of say, everything I've seen from the day, this is what I feel, this is what I saw.
Yeah, it sprung up organically, Kevin, like a lot of the best things. It wasn't a plan to do this. So two things. The passion for the sport, the day ended, and we were so excited about talking about college football, and tequila would be the second thing. You know, you get a little tequila in a red Solo cup, and you wind down, and you're just hanging with your buddies, and you're excited about the sport, and you have more to say, and you want to say it in a different way. I think what people have kind of gravitated to is why we do it, is it doesn't feel like a regular postgame show. It's unfiltered. It's raw. It's rambling. There is no one in your ear telling you. There are no commercial breaks. We try to wrap it up in 15 minutes because posting a video longer than that, Instagram TV, is kind of a pain. But other than that, there are no constraints. So we started doing it in the bus or maybe on the airplane if we were flying the same place or in the back of a car. And the weird lighting and strange setting kind of lends something to it. But now we just kind of keep it going, and it's fun to bring in not just Kirk, but also Chris Felica, Maria Taylor's been on, Tom Rinaldi was on, their various producers. We try to get different perspectives because it's just people winding down at the end of a college football Saturday, getting a little loose and expressing things in a different way than you would if the camera were in front of you. So that's the idea.
Now, we also had a piranha sighting as you get ready and prepare for the game, and you got your boards there. And, you know, some tidbit too, for, I think, you know, we have a lot of listeners at a variety stages of their life, but a lot of young, up-and-coming, aspiring broadcasters. And your preparation for this game, I found interesting where you were watching 30 minutes of the LSU-Clemson game with Billy Cannon. And, you know, and to me, that's 30 minutes of time taken away from working on your board. I think from the outside.
I didn't mean to do that, by the way. Don't you get just dragged down the wormhole sometimes? I mean, I was doing other things. That was a multitask thing, Kevin. I was watching the Sugar Bowl because it was the other time LSU finished undefeated. So I think I didn't mean to go there. I was like, okay, LSU's only perfect season came, you know, back in 58 when they won the championship way before that bowl game was played. But here comes Clemson into New Orleans as an underdog, and LSU had a Heisman Trophy winner eventually. And wow, the parallels are kind of crazy. Let me find this footage, which I did. And it was a half hour of footage, which included no scoring plays. As the game finished 7-0, Billy Cannon threw a halfback pass for a touchdown in the third quarter. For some bizarre reason, it was edited out of this game. So I watch every play of the game except the damn scoring play. I've seen it elsewhere. But yeah, that I thought I'm going to share this because it's so weird. I was working on my board. Don't worry about it. It wasn't a hollow 30 minutes, but it's also kind of fun because it had the play by play narration, not done live at the time, but after the fact, there's some voice in there going, and a handoff to Murphy, runs for 4 yards off the left side. It was kind of cool. And you know, maybe it was a boring game. They ran the T formation. Both teams had six completed passes combined. It's going to look nothing like Monday night. Thank God. You know.
Yeah. But what I was trying to say was, in the beginning, I'm like, okay, you're taking away from some time from the board. But to me, actually, you're doing a service, I think, for the audience, because you're doing extra research where you can kind of tap into that kind of conversation if you get there during the broadcast. And that just shows the different levels of preparation where I think too many times people think, hey, you're looking down at a card and you're like, okay, this guy got the ball, like you just said, with the play-by-play 50 years ago or 60 years ago. And now you've got to be prepared in so many other ways for every type of conversation in a national championship setting. So to me, it was a prop to you where you're like, I'm getting extra background here for a game like this. And I didn't know Clemson wore navy blue until you pointed that out on the video.
I didn't either.
And that was a different look, right?
First of all, let me say, you got 15 days, whatever. So you could never do that in a regular calendar of a game. You would never indulge yourself or waste that time. But there's so much time between the semis and the finals this year that you find yourself doing different sorts of preparation, you know, and then you have the luxury to do that.
What's it like? Obviously, this year a little bit different, but what's it like during a normal season? And next year it's going to be different too, with the Rose being a semifinal game. But normally, let's just say, for example, last year, you're calling a semifinal game. Then within 3 days, I mean, the next day you're on a flight to Pasadena and obviously preparing for the Rose. And then once you're done the Rose, you have, 8 days to get ready now for the national championship. What's it like when you go from boom, 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 game to game to game, and three very big games, maybe the biggest games you can make an argument on the college football schedule?
Well, first of all, you're flattered, excited to do it. It's a privilege. It's a dream kind of assignment. Preparation is a challenge. You have to work in the Rose Bowl ahead of time. You can't start preparing for the Rose Bowl 2-3 days out. So you spend time in December on both teams and watch some tape. Hopefully you know the teams, and we had done both Wisconsin and Oregon really late in the season, did the Ducks previous game, and Wisconsin had did their second to last game. So that made it easier. And then when the first game is done, you open that file, you get back up, you do a crash course. Play-by-play, as you know, Kevin, prepares differently than an analyst. Now, Kirk's job is he loves watching tape. He prepares as well as anybody, watches a ton of tape. I'll do that, but it's not in the same way he does. For me, the preparation comes much closer to kickoff by talking to the players and coaches. Talking to players is the biggest joy for me in terms of anything I do to prepare. And so I can't wait to get down to New Orleans and talk to both Tigers and kind of see where their head is and the coaches, watch practices. For me, it's the stuff that's really close to kickoff that's most important. So I'll have my board ready. I'll have watched a bunch of LSU and Clemson games to refresh the memory, but it's the stuff that's done from 48 hours to kickoff that's most important to me.
Now, I saw you the next day after Fiesta as we traveled to Pasadena, and you know, I'm a college football diehard fan, but also I love the business, and I made a comment to you that I wanted to hear the Trevor Lawrence touchdown run the way you saw it. I wanted to hear how you delivered it, because I to me, style is such an important thing, because it is about personality. It's also about that specific person, how they're seeing it through their eyes. But at the same time, you're aware of the audience. What goes into you being a play-by-play guy that's different from being an anchor? Like, when you think about your journey as a Sports Center anchor, game day host, you know, doing tennis to college football play-by-play, what do you think about when you're delivering a game, especially in the biggest stage?
Hopefully you try to free your mind of a lot of thought. I mean, football, unlike tennis, and I love the contrast, they're so different. Football is a see it, say it sport. So you're basically in real time letting it flow. You don't want to edit yourself too much. You want to just see what's going on and then say what's in your mind. And when a play like that unfolds, it's unexpected. You want to have sort of that natural enthusiasm, the childlike wonder, if that's a way to put it. You don't expect a 6'6 quarterback to gallop 67 yards for a touchdown. No one in the building expected it, including him. Mm-hmm. You let a play like that unfold, and hopefully what comes through is your genuine surprise. And, you know, you want to be able to punctuate it. I do wish I'd gone one line farther. As you play that back, you go, oh, you know what I wish I'd said is that play will live forever in the history of the sport, because it really will. Now, if you're going to pull the trigger and say that, you don't want to be wrong. You know, you have to be able to genuinely feel it in the moment. And when it's a play that decides the championship, like we got a chance to call Tua's touchdown pass to Devontae Smith to win a championship right on the spot for Alabama, like, you know, okay, that's a highlight forever. But Trevor Lawrence, out of nowhere, running for a 67-yard touchdown, hits you by surprise. And so then it's harder to sort of say, that will never be forgotten, and then punctuate it that way, because you can sound like a fool if you say that three times a game, right? Like, that's a special moment that happens. It's unexpected. You try to prepare for the unexpected and think, what would be the significance if this happens? But that was just so out of left field that you just never – his longest run, I think, was 26 yards or something before that run. So you never thought he's going to outrun Ohio State secondary. It was so much fun to watch, because it is – no matter how many times you think you've seen it, everything in college football, you're going to continually be surprised.
Do you go back and watch, or is this in the off season, or is this within a couple days? Do you watch a broadcast and take a look at what you did and what you didn't do? How do you handle that?
Yeah, I watch every game back to just try to see how it felt, what I would do better and different. I really do believe that it's a constant state of improvement. We're all unfinished products, I think, in all aspects of life, but certainly in this job and play-by-play in football, I feel like there's a lot of room for improvement. I want to listen back to see what could have been done better, what went well. In this case, I'll watch it back to prepare for the next game, because we just had Clemson, so it's easy. I'd probably watch this a couple times. But yeah, I mean, self-evaluation, being brutally honest with yourself. Sometimes, you know, you're cringing when you're watching it back, because you might pick up something that a viewer wouldn't, but you know you didn't do a great job with that call, or you could have said something better. And I think a lot of the job is foreshadowing. It's certainly documenting the play and storytelling, but having a sense for what might happen and preparing people for, hey, heads up, this is an important drive. It's an important moment. This play could decide the game. And sometimes when you fail to recognize that in the moment, but you have the benefit of hindsight, you go, why didn't you see that? Why didn't you point that out? And so it's always a process of listening back, judging yourself, and then sort of trying to improve on that.
You talk a little bit about getting the chance to meet the players building up to the game and the coaches. When do you get a sense of what's going to happen? Is it game day, or is it after a couple of meetings and sit downs and conversations on both sides?
Sometimes you have no clue. The more you prepare, the more you hear, the less you really know. because both sides can sound really confident. That's the way I felt with Ohio State Clemson. You go to both meetings and you go, wow, this side has a great plan. This side feels good about themselves. It's hard to pick against this team. And that's the way we felt after both Buckeyes and Clemson Tigers meetings. And so sometimes you do come out of the meeting and you go, wow, they ain't ready. They are not ready for what they're going to see. What they think the other side's going to do is not what the other side's going to do. And you got to sit there poker face in the meeting and not tip your hand. As you know, you're getting background from both sides. Mm-hmm. And you're aware in these meetings, I swear to God, Kevin, some coaches are really skilled. Urban Meyer used to do this. He would throw stuff out there and he'd be watching your reaction to see if what he thought Michigan was going to do is what you actually have been told they might do. And you got to be poker faced in that moment. And I think we do a good job of that because it comes through experience. But they're trusting you when they're telling you stuff in these meetings. You hope they trust you. They better, because if they don't, you're not going to get very good stuff. And they have to understand that whatever loyalties they think you might have, your loyalty to the viewer and your own career is way above everything else. So we would never spill secrets in a meeting. And they need to understand that. But yeah, sometimes you feel like you got a good picture. Sometimes you have no clue after all these meetings.
And before you have those meetings with these coaches and these players, before you go to New Orleans, what do you think this game is going to come down to?
A couple plays here and there, but performance in the big moments. You know, is A.J. Terrell going to break up a pass in the end zone when Joe Burrow is trying to find Chase down there in the red zone? Or is Lawrence or Burrow going to be accurate trying to find a tight end across the middle in the back of the end zone? To me, they're going to move the ball. Can't stop either offense. And it's going to happen, you know, in the red zone. And that's what decided the semifinal game with Ohio State. 500 yards offense against Clemson. They had the defense fused on their back heels. Clemson clamped down in the second half. But Ohio State had a chance to take a really commanding lead, as you know, in the first half and kick three short field goals. To me, that's what's going to happen on Monday night. LSU's going to move the ball. I mean, you're not going to stop Joe Burrow. They got five receivers in the pattern. He's going to find somebody. They're going to make their yards. It's whether or not they can score in explosive plays, or if Clemson's going to make him march the field and then stop him in the red zone, and then vice versa. You know, you're going to stop Lawrence and those guys. LSU's defense is not going to put up a stone wall and prevent first downs. Okay, that's just not going to happen. So it's who makes the most of their opportunities. To me, it'll be a small margin that decides things. And the difference in a high scoring game, which people think could happen, or kind of a medium scoring game, which we got in Glendale, is totally what happens on those third downs and in the red zone.
Yeah, and let's hope there's no controversy with the replay too.
Oh my God, let
the guys decide.
Can we have a game in the NFL or in college that doesn't involve a controversial call that's hard to explain to viewers? Because that's what you got to do, the same thing too. You got to try to make sense of these calls, these rules that half the coaches don't know well. The players don't understand what a catch is and isn't. It is frustrating. It is the essence of the sport, which is complicated, sloppy, beautiful, controversial, all rolled into one. But I would love to not have a targeting call, a catch, non-catch. I mean, let's just not have it be decided by that. I watch the same thing in these NFL playoff games. Like, can we just not have it come down to that, please? It always seems to.
And we've seen the evolution of TV broadcasts where the rules experts have now become stars, like Mike Pereira, who does an excellent job, but he's now part of the broadcast, where I think people are like, I want to hear from him, because we have so many questions as these things play out with the rules, as of course with replay and what it's done and how it's changed, how we break down a game. The one thing I think is a huge storyline too is, and Dabo will probably downplay it, even though he is fully aware of it, and he talks about it a lot. If they win this game, it's 30 straight wins. It's back-to-back national championships at 15-0 in the playoff era. You're a guy that loves the sport, that's been a part of the sport for three decades, that has covered it in and out. Where would you put this Clemson team and what Dabo has done when we talk about the greatest teams of all time?
Man, at or near the top, because they're doing stuff you're not supposed to be able to do. In the modern era, you're not supposed to be able to go 15-0, let alone twice in a row. I know their conference schedule isn't as demanding as many teams in the past that have been among the all-time greats. I understand that. They're way better than the ACC. But if you focus what they've done in the postseason and how they've won their championships, you know, the first time beating an undefeated Alabama team who's 14-0. You know, last year, Notre Dame, you can say they're overrated, but they beat a 12-0 Notre Dame team, and they beat an undefeated Alabama team again. This year, you beat a 13-0 Ohio State team that many people thought was the best Big Ten team they had ever seen, okay? And there was evidence to back that up. So you beat them. Now you go to New Orleans, and if you beat a 14-0 LSU team with this off-the-charts offense, I don't know how you'd say something's been better than that. 3 out of 4 years is rarefied stuff, as you know, Kevin. And it's been done by Notre Dame, Rockne, Nebraska under Osborne, with one of those titles being a shared championship, a split poll. To do it in the playoff era, where you got to earn everything on the field, and you got to beat these undefeated teams that are considered all-time greats as well. How is it? How do you find something better than that? I don't know. I think it's right there at the top.
And the most fascinating thing, I think, leading into the game and the environment will be it. I'm not saying it's a home game for LSU, but for a national championship, it's not going to be an even split in that building, and how loud that environment's going to be for Clemson to deal with the, I think,
hey man, it's close
outside
to a home
elements.
Game. I've seen LSU play for 3 championships in that dome. They won 2, lost 1. It was a home game all the time. I mean, it really was. The time they played Alabama and got shut out 21-0 in the worst championship game I've ever seen, it was quiet because they had no chance to move the ball. But it was a pro LSU crowd. And the other 2 times when they beat Oklahoma under Saban and then they beat Ohio State, it was roaring. It was electric. It's going to be close to that, I think, Monday night. So it's a home game. And if Clemson overcomes that, it's just, to me, that's punctuation for this all-time great run. If you beat LSU, that's where you started to go with this. If you beat them down there in that game, that to me is that's an incredible cherry on top of it.
And then on the other side, it's been highly discussed how you would stack Joe Burrow's season compared to the all-time greats. And I'm not overlooking a lot. I think Cam Newton's season in 2010, if you put that and stacked it up as a one-year run, that may be one of the greatest seasons as a quarterback in, I think, the last 50 years. What Joe Burrow is doing, can you put it into words in comparisons to what we've seen in the past?
Again, right at or near the top. Cam Newton's a good example, difficult on offense, carried the team as a runner and a passer, you know, showed up first year as a starter, takes him to a championship. Burrow, to me, is a different kind of quarterback, but the level of dominance, his level of expertise at every measurable way that you evaluate quarterbacks is unreal. Under pressure, against the blitz, win behind, fourth quarter, hadn't had to do a lot in the fourth quarter, but his numbers in the fourth quarter, if you break those down, off the charts. I think it's a unique blend of scheme, elite, cerebral, and underrated physical quarterback and playmakers. So you put 5 guys in the pass pattern every time, and you have a quarterback that gets the ball out as fast as he does, and guys who do with the ball with what these playmakers do, that's why I think you got these historic numbers, and that's why it's the ultimate challenge for Brent Venables and the defense, but I think they're the ultimate challenge for LSU too. So that's what makes it so incredibly compelling whenever LSU has the ball. Can they continue to do it? My question for LSU was not what they'd done, but how would they handle the pressure of the postseason? Because it was like a road game when they faced Georgia too. They went in there. I was on the field watching Burrow for the first time live field level. It was really interesting, really, really instructive. How would he handle his first postseason game, his first real pressure postseason game? Because he was actually pretty shaky in their bowl game against UCF last year before he kind of turned it around. So this is a whole nother thing. Beautifully is the answer to the question. with Edwards-Helaire not really healthy, he just carried him. He was running, he was throwing, he was doing everything, leading, thinking. And I thought, wow, that's just that answered one question. Now you go to the semifinal. How is he going to handle that? Everybody's telling him you're going to blow out Oklahoma. Okay, you just get to the Superdome. Okay, get rid of these guys. Get to New Orleans. And how do you come out and play like that? I don't even know how that's possible. 7 touchdowns in the first half. It's almost flawless. And Oklahoma had actually been playing better defense lately. I don't know how. So that to me is what makes this so intriguing, because you know you can count on Lawrence in the postseason. I mean, how can you bet against him? He is so clutch, so accomplished, rock solid in every playoff game he's ever played, every conference championship game he's ever played, never thrown a pick in any postseason game. But you got Joe on this side who's answered a lot of questions. It's still not the same as a championship game with all the pressure of playing in New Orleans. I mean, I think that's an extra layer of challenge for him. Yeah, the crowd's on their side, but it's more pressure too. So I can't wait to see how he handles that. It's just sort of like the last piece of the puzzle to one of the great seasons, maybe the greatest season we've ever seen as a quarterback in the sport.
And he comes off so cool and always in control no matter what. You watched it and experienced it with him, Heisman night, as you're the host of the Heisman. And you make the presentation, and then he has to deliver a speech. What was it like seeing him in that environment? Because, again, he won the night with his emotional speech, and then, of course, talking about his hometown, and then this turns into raising money. Everything, it seems that he's around, everybody he seems around, like they rally around him, they're attracted to him, and he's also just cool about the entire approach.
Yeah, it was startling. I mean, 26 years of having the privilege to present the Heisman and 26 speeches, I have to say that was the most memorable, because he'd been almost robotic throughout the whole process. That's kind of his method. He's very flatline, not emotional at all. And I'd met with him during the season, along the awards trail, throughout the Heisman run-up. He was almost robotic that day. His name is called, which is no surprise. I think he knew he was going to win. And he just turns into a puddle. And it was beautiful. And he told me he cried more in that speech than he had in all 23 years of his life. And caught him off guard. And to see him break down when thanking his parents, he goes right to his offensive line. Then as he starts to unfold with the speech, he gets more emotional. Coach Orgeron, he breaks down. It was beautiful to see, man. It was way longer than we thought it was going to be. I was telling the producers, you know, we're not supposed to go long with that show, Kevin. We're supposed to get to boxing. So the announcement was earlier this year to allow for a long speech. And, you know, I said, listen, I don't think Joe's going to go more than 4 or 5 minutes. Don't worry about it. But he gets up there, and we all know what happened. And it was a gift to the rest of us. I think his speech, as you mentioned, raising money. Like, who thinks of that? I saw his card was very small. He did not have a speech. It wasn't all written out. It was some very brief bullet points on a very small piece of paper. And when he starts talking about Athens, Ohio, and the kids that come home after school and don't have food on the table, I thought, wow, this is going to go in some powerful places that I didn't expect. I don't think he expected to have the impact that it did, where $500,000 was raised for those kids. I mean, what an incredible gift to be able to have the presence of mind to think about your hometown and present it in a way that inspired others to give. I saw him the next night at the Heisman Gala, and we talked about the speech. And I know by that point, the emotion was gone from him. He'll never be like that in his life again, I predict. Even if he wins a championship. Even if he does great things on Sunday, I think that was a unique 10 minutes in the life of a pretty unemotional guy. And I was just so glad I was, 10 feet away to watch it.
Special moment. And Monday night could cap off a very special season. You mentioned 26 years as the presenter of the Heisman, and over 20 years, the original host of Game Day. And you go from SportsCenter to Game Day, now to play-by-play. When you get the chance on Saturdays to watch Game Day now, as a guy that was in the middle of that and that started it, What's it like? How are you watching game day? Because we all watch, people in the business watch TV completely different. But for you, this is your baby. How do you watch game day now in the mornings, considering that you're on the other side, no longer hosting it? What's it like for you?
Yeah, good question. It's changed over time. You know, it was very emotional at first when I kind of said goodbye, and the first show of the year following my last year as host was an out-of-body experience. Got very choked up talking to the crowd, the crew, and the guys on the set. And then it was difficult to watch from start to finish. My Saturday mornings are pretty busy. We have our production meetings for our game. I try to get a workout in. It's about getting my mind and body in the right frame of mind to do the job at 8 o'clock at night. So it includes watching game day, but not in the same way as you might think. First of all, what I found out too, no disrespect, as I said this when I hosted the show, 3 hours is a damn long show.
Yes, it is.
I don't know anybody wants or needs a 3-hour pregame show. I'm being honest here, okay? I thought the show, for me, the years that I did it, I don't judge it now, were easier and I think better when it was 2 hours versus three. I'm just keeping it 100% real. So I realize when I'm a viewer, that's a long show. And it's a marathon, as you presented. It's a huge challenge to what Reese and those guys do to keep the energy going for 3 hours. I can't do that. My schedule doesn't allow it. As time has passed, I'm able to watch it. I don't have any kind of emotional feelings watching game day. It's a good, really good show. And so I get a lot out of it. But when they talk about the game I'm calling, I want to know what they have to say. I want to see Tom Rinaldi and Wojo's features. I want to prepare for my game by watching what they have to say. And it's also a way to keep in touch with the rest of the landscape. So I'm not that far from a regular viewer at this point. The shows that are the morning of the championship game, which you mentioned, that's a little bit different. Like, obviously it's 100% focused on the LSU Clemson game. So I'll be interested in what they have to say as much as I can watch it. But as you know, we have a job to do, and that's to take care of our block of time. And so whatever gets you ready for that is what you end up doing.
You mentioned Reese and Reese coming in, that transition, not easy. He's done a phenomenal job of handling, hey, we're expanding, but also I'm making sure that we're staying true to the tenets of why game day was such a fixture for college football fans for over 20 years when you used to host it. But one thing that I love is that you guys, wherever you go, getting mixed up for each other. And I'm stunned by that. As a guy that
you enjoy that, Kevin. You get a laugh.
I did.
You see me get a kick.
Because as a guy that gets mixed up with, you know, Dari Noka ever since I came to ESPN for 13 years, and we talk about, you know, I've had people talk to me about
Okay, I take it back. You can relate. You can understand.
Totally can relate. Totally.
Yeah, it's
great. What's it like for you?
What else are you going to do? But handle it with good humor. What can either of us do? But
yes.
On the same point, like, I mean, part of me, and I know Reese, we've done a video about this. We've talked about this a lot. We talked about it last week. We talked about it at the Heisman dinner, which he was hosting. you know, we stood together and said, different people, not the same guy. We look a little alike. We do some of the same things, but we're not the same human. You know, I mean, which I'm sure you can relate to. It's like, hey, I have no problem being compared to Reese. I'm flattered. He does a phenomenal job. I think he feels to some degree. But are you watching closely? If you're a, quote, big fan, I'm a big fan. If you're a big fan of game day, you should notice that after 6 years of not doing it, I'm not doing it. Reese, well, there's a resemblance, but he has his own style. He's an accomplished guy that's been around for 25 years as well. There's a different host, people. Catch on.
Yeah.
He's not doing the games at night, you know. So that's why we tried to have fun. I mean, look, you guys get mixed up. I guess from what they've said, all the Jimmys at night get mixed up. You know, Jimmy Fallon, Jimmy Kimmel, even James Corden, Colbert. I mean, nobody can keep them straight either. So I understand. People's lives are complicated. They got more important stuff than to sort out announcers. But God, it would be nice not to have, you know, people yell Reese when I'm walking to do a game and he gets Chris, hey Chris. I mean, that can't feel great for him either. He's doing his great job hosting the show, trying to make his mark, and there's people who are confused. But hey, like I said, it ain't that big a problem. You got to handle it with good humor.
Yeah, we have fun with it. And Dari and I have talked about it. Yeah, well, see, I've always told Dari, my future's in his hands, so don't screw it up, because if they all think that we're the same, he's got to be really good. Same way with me. I've got to hold my ground because they think Dari is on SportsCenter.
How many times do you get, though, you idiot, you moron, how dare you? I wasn't on game day. That's why we did this video. Listen, if you want to criticize game day, call Reese. If you hated Saturday night, don't talk to him about it. Just keep the criticism thing straight, because you don't want to take heat for something somebody else did.
Hey, you've been at ESPN, 30 years at least, right? Am I accurate with that? 33? Is there anything that you still want to do in your career that you want to add to what you're already doing with college football and your tennis duties? And I know you host the Warrior Games. Like, is there something else out there that you're just like, maybe I'd like to dabble with that as well?
You know, I think I'm really at peace with what I'm doing. When I was coming up, I thought hosting the Olympics would be the ultimate job, because I grew up watching Jim McKay do the job and then later Costas. And I thought that the Olympics are just a special, special thing, the pinnacle of sports. I changed my mind about that. I don't think the Olympics are presented quite the same way. And Mike Trinker's got a dream assignment, but I'm very comfortable never working the Olympics. Even though I still watch them and attend them as a fan, I love doing the World Cup, man. I'm a huge soccer fan. So when we had the World Cup rights, having the honor of hosting that in South Africa was unforgettable. And man, it stung when Fox took the rights away from us. I would love to get the World Cup back. I would love to be involved in huge international soccer, whether that's the Euro Championships or the World Cup again. I mean, and then there's special projects that sort of come along, like the Invictus Games, where it was very cool to meet Michelle Obama and Prince Harry and a lot of very powerful people who were the athletes at the Games for Wounded Warriors. That was unforgettable. Special things that come up that like that, I think, will always be important to me. But nah, you know, I know that I'm not suited to call the Stanley Cup Finals. That was my initial sport that I loved. I absolutely love hockey, love the NHL, but I'll leave that to people that are specialists in that. I'll leave soccer calling to people that grew up around it and truly feel it. I think you got to know your limitations. Could you study and do it? Yeah. And people do it brilliantly. There are a lot of versatile broadcasters out there, and I like to think that what I've done with different skill sets, I'm proud of. But man, I think that at the high level, you got to do more than do homework. You got to feel it properly. And the guys who do soccer at a high level feel it in their bones. I'll leave it to them. And I just don't want to do anything that I don't feel like I can do at a really high level at this point. And just, you know, pulling out the 3-wood, putting it in the fairway, green in regulation, shoot 72. Nothing wrong with that. You're asked to do things in your career that you know you don't really feel. I did the X Games for a long time. I did NASCAR, because they asked me to do it. And I can go be a pro broadcaster and kind of carry it off. And it's fun. I loved it. Horse racing, I loved. Super challenging. And I did feel that a little bit more. But you know, I'm really happy just doing my two favorite sports at this point, and whatever falls as an opportunity within the framework of the company, I'm cool. But I've got a long-term deal, and I'm really happy there.
Quality over quantity. I definitely appreciate that.
Absolutely.
And whenever we have somebody that's part of the ESPN broadcast team on the podcast, I always ask this final question, because I think it's really important from different perspectives, especially for aspiring broadcasters. Any advice that you would give through your 40 years in the business and what you've gone through, you know, through college, through, you know, your 20s to the last 33 years here at ESPN that sticks out to you that you would kind of give to yourself if you were entering the business?
Yeah, I mean, it's a long conversation. It's hard to say one thing, but being authentic is number one. Being yourself. Remembering what it is about this profession that sparked an interest in, that goes for any career, by the way. If But I think when you jump into a career that's supposed to be, quote, fun, we're doing this because we love it, not because, you know, we thought we were going to make a pile of money or be famous. I hope it's not those things. I tell young podcast students, please, please don't have those as motives when you get into this, because you're going to be disappointed. Do the great work, have a blast doing it. And if things sort themselves out, all those rewards will come. But don't aim at that. Please don't aim at that, because that's just a mistake in any profession. And when you have choices, follow your gut. If you have different opportunities, if you're lucky enough to do good work and then present A versus B, listen to your gut, your inner voice, not the experts, not your logical mind, because as you know, sometimes the best decisions are the ones you make with your gut and your heart, and finding the peace of mind to let the inner voice come through and guide you, not to get too deep or mumbo jumbo, but that is the key to success in life. Having opportunities that present themselves and knowing what's the wrong one and what's the right one. And it's so important to avoid the wrong choices. And sometimes you can make the wrong choice by doing what you think you're supposed to do or what somebody else tells you you should do to have success. I would have made 5 wrong choices in my career, at least, if I'd have made the logical choice and not the choice from the gut. And so that's in a nutshell, I think, what it is. Do great work, be humble, enjoy the process, not just the hours in front of the camera, but the process of preparing. You got to love that too. You're never going to be happy and successful. And then make the right choices when you're presented with different options.
Outstanding advice, Chris. And we appreciate you joining us here on the podcast. And cannot wait for Monday night. Looking forward to your call. I'm sure we'll talk in New Orleans. But thanks again for joining us here as we get ready for the
next. I appreciate your work, Kevin. Thank you. Enjoyed it. Great questions. And we'll do it again. Had a great time.
You got it, buddy. Take care. And that'll do it for this week here on the College Football Podcast with Herbie and Pollock. Special thanks to Chris Fowler for joining us to talk about a variety of topics. Of course, breaking down the game, what he's looking forward to, but love the story about Joe Burrow on Heisman night, and also phenomenal advice for, I think, anybody, not just broadcasters, but young people in college or in their 20s about the journey and enjoying the entire experience. So great words from Chris. And of course, he's going to have a fantastic call on Monday night. Cannot wait for that game. Special thanks to our producer, Taylor Schwenk, always doing a great job on the other side to make sure this podcast comes to you. I've had a lot of fun this season, and we're not done. Obviously, we get ready for the final game of the season on Monday night. But coming up next week, we'll have a recap. Herbie and Pollock are going to join us together with their thoughts on what they saw from Clemson and LSU. Until then, enjoy the biggest game of the season.